So the mystery of mind certainly is something that overrides all of life for anyone of a serious bent, of a seeker of truth. And this morning we're looking at the dual nature of mind. So there will be two presentations, the first on what's called higher mind, and the second presentation on what's called lower mind. But even though we're talking about a duality, we're reminded from the very, very beginning that this is a great mystery. The mind is where we live, and we know that. We know it intimately. And yet, the mind, the function of the mind, the powers of the mind remain a puzzle. We're aware that we have a whole range of powers and possibilities and tendencies, ranging from perhaps a once in a great while flash of intuition or insight, all the way over to imaginative use of logic, reasoning from premise to conclusion. Science, popular science and psychology, is puzzled because, on one hand, the mind seems to be immaterial, and on the other hand, there's the function of the brain, which also seems to pertain to mind. So function and attribute is a mystery, but it is one. In the world of the theosophical philosophy, mind is said to be the link between the spirit of God and the personal below. It is frequently referred to as manas, the fifth principle, the root, the spirit, the force, the angelic. And we know that when we hear the fundamentals presented in the lodge, the beginning proposition is that there is an abstract, unknowable, all-inclusive, absolute oneness. And from that, in that, emerging from that, like the image in the dark room emerges on the film strip. Mind is a oneness coming out of that absolute, and then gradually, with as a principle or a power, it also eventually is known as manifested as an entity or an ego. The absolute, we're told in the philosophy, is an eternal, beyond the solar system, unknowable essence. And all manifestation from that becomes more and more dense or physical, less and less ethereal across the great ages. From the principle of manas, we can begin to imagine what certain essences of principles might be. And we're told that there's a higher nature to the soul that is using the physical frame and the physical instrument right now. We're told that there is buddhi, and told that desire first arose in it, the absolute, the intuitive, the spiritual. We're told as well that manas, or mind, which we use as a cognitive tool, is the lowest of those aspects. In many ways, is the instrument of buddhi, the same way that buddhi is the instrument of the absolute, the Atma. Along the way of evolution, what we're informed about is that initially there is a sense coming out of the absolute that begins to develop as a universal oversoul, if you will. We're referred to mind as the product of the Manasaputra, as a plurality of an essence of thought. And we're told from the very beginning there's power, and then the possible application of power, a duality, a potential, and a practical use, if you will, from the very, very beginning. We also hear in the philosophy, we read in the philosophy about the monad, that as evolution proceeds, there are stages of existence, of intelligence, that are not self-conscious, therefore are not creative powers. And in that way, they're considered mindless, but mind in potential. About 18 million years ago, mind is said to have been lit up among the monadic essences. And what comes, what is the emergence of that, is that spirit, soul, and mind commune and bloom in those souls, those entities that are going to use the human state. Those of us that are using the human state, where we are self-aware, if you will, to some degree, we know that we use mind to act on this plane or that plane. We know that we use mind based in mental and spiritual conditions, and we can see an array of use of mind in our fellow humans all around the world. And for this morning's talk, from the spiritual side, Buddhi manas is a possibility, where the perceiver, the witness, the knower, is a spiritual, eternal entity and has the possibility, the great possibility, of full discernment at all planes of existence, an intuition, a direct cognition, if you will, from within, without. At the same time, the duality of the use of mind is that we are perceivers in periodic form, and we sense, or we think about, or we create through logic, reason, will, and choice, aspects of the physical, personal life. But higher mind, that Buddhi nature that is the goal of all seekers of truth, is purer. It's closer to the original source, even though it is at one with the powers of the lower mind. In Christianity, in Matthew, we read about instructed prayer or meditative prayer directed to our Father who art in heaven. And in that essence, what we have is the nature of what it is to be a spiritual, mindful entity within, a causal force of life, creating skandhas, creating matrices for future growth, using animal soul, human soul, spiritual soul, reaching towards spiritual soul, always hoping and envisioning as much as we can, Ishvara, that shining self within. So in this way, we've got a duality. We have the ego, or the thinking man in the microcosm, echoing logos, or the universal mind at the highest level. We have soul powers impressed within, and in full use, in and out throughout the source of any incarnation. But the real plane of all action is mind. Mind is the creator of karma. Mind is the experiencer of karma. And it is greatly colored, if you will, by the heart, by the motive held within. So that's a bit about the source of mind as a principle and as an entity, and a bit about the spiritual side, the highest essence of mind. And the next talk will be on the practicalities of the lower essence of mind.
So we have just heard a talk on the nature of higher mind. We'll now look at the aspect of mind that is what we normally experience throughout our day. And that aspect is what we can call the personality. There is a difference between personality and the individuality. Individuality is more associated with the higher mind, the higher triad, the reincarnating ego that we just heard about, whereas personality involves just this, the experiences in just this life, our characteristics, our memories, experiences, all of that, and it's transitory. Whereas the individuality, that higher, transfers from life to life to life, the personality is transitory and we get a new personality with each life. And a lot of what impacts that lower mind, that personality, is the lower mind. And we just heard about universal mind. It proceeds from the divine, but when in manifestation, it individualizes and becomes dual into that higher and lower aspect of mind. But as we heard, it is not the two, the higher and the lower, are not separate from each other, but the higher and lower are just two aspects of the one mind, like a hand, the front and the back of a hand. It's all one hand, two different aspects of it. So that's basically what higher and lower mind are in man. And in man, manas is lit up. It's self-conscious. It can reason from premise to conclusion, whereas the lower kingdoms are not able to do that. And when man is self-conscious, we just heard that it is the reincarnating aspect of our nature. It is ego, Atma Buddhi Manas. And at this point, our progress is based upon self-induced and self-devised means, also known as the pivotal doctrine, that no matter what happens, it's our choices, our responsibility, and that we can't expect to pray to an outside being that we are forgiven or to help us or to make the choices for us. But we have to be aware that in manifestation, since mine is dual, these choices will have to depend upon our motive. The way we choose to act, will it be from a higher or from a lower aspect? And it is then when the faculty of mind comes into play, and depending upon if it is higher or lower, we'll make that choice. So it is the thinking, perceiving principle that differentiates us from the lower kingdoms. Mind is in all what we call monads, which is the evolutionary aspect of everything that lives. It carries on the evolutionary process, but again, it is only conscious when it's lit up in the human kingdom. It is the reincarnating immortal monad who carries the results and values of all different lives that have been lived. Mind is a pivotal principle in the sevenfold nature of man. And as was said in the first talk, that higher mind is joined with Buddhi, and we have that entity that is known as Buddhi Manas, Whereas with lower mind is joined with kama, or the passions and desires. And it has to be this way, because the lower mind, when joined to manas, this is where all our choices are made. This is where we determine what our karma is going to be. This is where our responsibility is. This is where we learn our lessons. Mind is individual, while Atma and Buddhi are the universal principles, one and the same for all. It is the latent or active potential essence of every form, the basis of every law, the potency of every principle in the universe. In the lower kingdoms, right now, mind is not lit up, but it is there. It is not self-conscious. Our connection with the manifested universe is through mind, and it is the lower mind that connects with the passions and desires, and this is where our motive comes in, why we are doing what we're doing, our choices, and it is how the potential for progress is innate at this point. Man uses reason to make decisions, and most people think that reason would be of a higher attribute, but it's not. The higher mind uses intuition and does not depend upon reason, but the lower mind does use reason. So how can we elevate our lower mind in a more consistent basis then? Since the main purpose of the lower mind's existence is to be in contact with kama, the passions and desires, then we need to look at our connection with those passions and desires. It is said that behind will stands desires. So any of our actions then will have to be affected by the desire principle. So we would need to look at our desires in order to determine our motive and how we are going to respond to any situation. We know, according to the Bhagavad Gita, that it is our duty to fulfill anything that comes to us. So lower mind needs to assess what that duty is, what is the impact not only on ourselves, but on others. How will that impact our choices, whatever it is that we're going to do? How is that going to affect others? In which case, if we can say that it is good for all, then that would be a good motive and fulfilling our duty. So we are influenced, as we just said, by our passions and desires, at which time it can disconnect with the higher. So with that, we need to be able to determine our motive and our choices. And we do want to just read a little bit about lower mind from The Ocean of Theosophy by Mr. Judge, and it's from page 56. Lower mind operating through the brain, and we need to point out that the brain is a vehicle for mind, and we don't remember our past lives because we get a new brain each life. That is to say, lower mind operating through the brain is that once altered into the shape and other characteristics of any object, mental or otherwise. This causes it to have four peculiarities. First, to naturally fly off from any point, any object or subject. And we all know, especially with meditation, anything can distract us. Second, to fly to something pleasant, a pleasant idea. And third, fly to an unpleasant idea so we can be distracted by something pleasant or not pleasant. And this is all the lower mind acting. And fourth, to remain passive and considering nothing. So just being passive, we know, is not really the best for our mind and how we can act. So that is the end of our talk for today. So either the first or second speaker will take questions and we will answer as we can. And we have a question here at Theosophy Hall.
What is meant by fly off? It's sort of, I mean, we've heard flight of ideas. Sometimes it's said that somebody is flighty, meaning they're kind of have trouble concentrating or following a line, or they're not paying attention. Their thoughts are here, there, and everywhere. And that is often, it's not uncommon in today's world with the numerous distractions that we have today. So by fly off, where's it flying from and where's it flying to?
So this whole idea of it's the first cause that the mind can't concentrate. It says to naturally fly off from any point, object, or subject. So what is meant by fly? Well, if we watch a bird, it flies like from one branch to another branch to another tree, and it looks flighty. So we're figuring that that is what is meant, that that is what the mind is doing. It is flying. It, you know, you're sitting there trying to concentrate, something comes in and you're flying over to something else. It distracts you. So we figured that that is why it's called flying, because it's so much like what a bird does.
So it's possible to consider mind as a principle, as a power that has energy and force and potential. And if there is something amiss with the physical brain, we say that somebody may have attention deficit disorder. They're scatterbrained, if you will. They can't hold a particular focus. But theosophically speaking, that's the natural tendency of the force of mind to generate ideas, to generate concepts, and to try to make meaning. And so in the lower mind, if there's no control, if there's no focus, if there's no motive to remain focused, then that lack of motivation will create a passivity and allow this mind principle of force unto itself to soar high and low wherever it wants to go. In the East, it's called the monkey mind phenomena. And it's something each one of us deals with to some degree. And it's probably a rampant, uncontrolled use of imagination. And we're happy to say that next Sunday, there'll be a talk on the training of mind, which will deal with flights of fancy and otherwise.
We have a follow-up here in Theosophy Hall.
So it sounds like when the mind flies, it's because it's passive, it's not paying attention. But since psychism is developing, is it also psychic and astral, or is that, we're not, we're wondering if that's a factor. So
we're not quite sure on that. And Sal, do you have an answer for that?
Well, there seems to be two types of passivity described here. One's a passivity of lack of control or giving up, choosing to give up control, so that the natural motion of the mind, because it is an extension of that universal principle, which is in constant motion, is to move from one idea to another, whether it be pleasant or unpleasant. But then there's another kind of passivity where we consciously choose to leave the mind blank or force ourselves to think of nothing. Kind of a paradox, because something that's constantly moving is being forced to consider naught. And it sounds like that was what the contributor was referring to, that psychic passivity that develops from a practice of blankness or complete susceptibility to whatever comes in without any discernment or discrimination.
Thank you.
And discernment is one of the powers of higher mind. It is coupled with intuition, if you will, direct cognition. And spiritual discernment is that power that we can use in the human state to discern the dearer from the better course of action. It's the basis of choice, and it's acquired skill across many lives, because truly we begin to understand what it is to think creatively and purely, and then we begin to discern what it is to act, to take that initial action of thought and bring it into the world of manifestation in the proper way.
We have a comment here in Theosophy Hall.
Yeah, what comes to mind is the teachings that it's so important to be one-pointed in your thinking, in your focus on what's important. And yet there are a lot of folks who kind of pride themselves on being able to multitask. And what we find interesting is that there's literature. In fact, Deepak Chopra gave a lecture on multitasking, and he said that multitasking is the only thing that a brain can do and get worse. The more it does it, the worse it gets at. Isn't that interesting?
Oh, yes. And we know that there are many jobs that require people to multitask, that they wouldn't be able to get their work done unless they did multitask. And we think once the brain has learned to multitask, it's hard to break that. But we understand, as was just stated, that it is important to remain one-pointed, because that is, I mean, the brain and the mind can certainly work better if it can focus all of its energy on one thing. And we think many people, if they get distracted, that once it's down to the wire for whatever they need to get done, then they're able to focus, but not until that point. So it is, we think, a necessary action that we need to develop in regards to being able to focus much better is to be one-pointed. Mm. And we know that doing that during meditation is hard, but it is good practice to try and just focus on one higher aspect.
We see evidence of this very naturally throughout the course of life. The primary caregiver of an infant quickly learns the duty of multitasking and juggling, so to speak, while they're caring for the infant, caring for a home, and maybe even pursuing a career. We might, in our daily course of life, encounter an example in a cashier in a store. We might see an example at a receptionist who is a quote office manager as well in a place of business or a medical practice. These are folks that have duties that appear to make them incredibly busy on the physical level in terms of multitasking. But we're reminded that the Gita has instructions that the very wise who remain well rested and centered are very aware that they're doing nothing while they're fulfilling these external duties. And they can at the same time, as mind beings, step back like anthropologists, like participant observers. They can step back into a spiritual stance and observe, witness the use of the lower mind as it needs to be efficient to fulfill these duties in the outer world. Stepping back 24/7, trying to be introspective, rejuvenates, refreshes, realigns, if you will, the use of the mind.
JB?
Yes, we know that man is a seven principled being, Manas being the fifth principle of the upper triad. How do we account for man? I mean, we know that there's seven principles when we're incarnate and we're in a physical body and we're operating this way. After death states, you know, there's the monad, the ego. Can we consider man still operating in three principles, or how do we understand man, you know, from being incarnate and other states after being, you know, physically incarnate, operating or just existing in Manas, Buddhi, and Atma, the ego. What's the differentiation between a seven principled existence versus an immortal or an egoistic existence?
Well, we think, well, if we're looking at the sevenfold nature, the four lower principles, which the body, the astral body, prana, and the passions and desires, they're only temporary. So at the point of death, well, we know about the after death states, then the higher triad then goes into Devakan, and that's where all the higher desires are impressed upon its nature and worked through for the next coming life. So in the after death states, everything, all the negative, all the lower desires are sloughed off in Kamaloka. Then the higher triad is into Devakan, and that's where Atma and Buddhi and Manas, that's where they work through the higher desires before the new life is developed.
There's a hand from VW. VW, did you want to speak?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, thank you.
Awesome. interactionism is the sum of is the sum total of what action in the mind takes place, and this doesn't happen without the body. And so they're associated with one another, but that is as far as that action goes. There's an association. And that's kind of a conflict of interest if we want to get in to figure out a dual mode that the mind alone has, nature, which is it, itself. And it is inappropriate to separate those two. So the manas seems to be the dual mode for the mind. However, reincarnation and thoughts, perhaps some metaphysical inquiry, so to speak, might very well wedge the body or the physical into that perspective, where that modality or that dual mode is then encountering or facing the higher manas, which it is then the lower manas. And it's it's still in mind. The physical is still being mindfully taken care of in perhaps a subliminal fashion, so to speak. But nonetheless, there's the ego, and then kind of overwhelming it is the philosophy, or philosophy, not the philosophy, but philosophy in general. And this is inspiring what's called a personality. And that shows how the mind does have its reach to go out there. And perhaps we could look at where its nature is. But then there's the association that's maybe there and maybe it's not in philosophy, while in reality, it very well is. So it becomes psychological, actually. And then metaphysics is something that there's a pro and a con to it. There's something that might facilitate this. Healing.
Let me see if I can.
But then there's a con too, because it's didactic and it can be kind of patronizing metaphysics in general. So that might kind of be a barrier.
So you're back. Is well taken that we can play what's, for lack of better words, mind games. We can get very enmeshed in metaphysical imagination, an extension of thought, and become so distracted from the physical plane that we're excruciatingly self-centered and almost like an escapist, almost like a nirvani in physical life, where the duality needs to be brought back and fine-tuned into a degree of oneness. So that while in the physical, while on this plane, while using those lower principles, mind is able to empower them in a practical, applied fashion, and then serve others. Maya Angelou said, you know, when we know better, we do better. And that's the key to that oneness, to bringing heart and head together, not only metaphysically in isolation like in an ivy tower, but rather in life, physical, astral, and otherwise.
And also the lower becomes so enmeshed in the physical that sometimes it's impossible to break that portion of mind away from what is going on in the physical. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people are so obsessed with fashion and of course your health, and to the detriment of any kind of higher thought. So in order to break away, this is the plane where we learn our lessons, is in the physical. And that is tempting to just get lost in what your body's doing. But being aware that we need to continually throughout the day try and focus on higher. And we have a comment.
We have a chat too. Is the comment in line with the same thinking?
It's about concentration. Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah.
So yoga, the yoga aphorisms of Patanjali are a primer for concentration and meditation. And in it, it mentions that there are five kinds of the mind. The modifications of the mind are of five kinds: correct cognition, misconception, fancy, sleep, and memory. My question is, does altruism aid in concentration?
Does altruism aid in concentration?
There's a portion of the voice that says that self-knowledge is of kind deeds the child. So that altruism, empathy, thinking from the perspective of the other, attempting to restore harmony in the physical life around us, all of those acts of service and gentle kindness would bring a kind of a reunited buddhi manas, wouldn't it? It would become the seeds for habitual action in the future and the inspiration for others around us. Eventually, self-knowledge, wisdom of thought, pure thinking would emerge.
So I guess we can look at the chat.
Okay. There's now two. The first one is, what is the subconscious mind according to theosophy? Well, we know in the realm of popular culture, psychology, etc., the function of the subconscious mind is to store and retrieve data, if you will. It's as though there's an automatic pilot that can be triggered. There's acquired knowledge, perhaps of a base kind, that is in abeyance. It's in the wings waiting, and circumstances might trigger a memory of that data, and we therefore might have a habit to pursue or a new way to apply that information. Theosophy says that mind is a memory bank, that buddhi is the spiritual and intuitive memory bank, so that as powers and principles in the philosophy, we have an explanation for why there appears to be a, quote, subconscious mind, power in potential that's waiting in the wings to be accessed when appropriate. And again, that takes discernment, not automatic triggering and reflex reactivity. Does the co-chair have any other observations on that? No? Okay. There's a second query. Are principles independent of personality and considered higher mind? Whoa, good question.
Well, the idea of the personality is looked at as being the lower mind. And the higher mind is the individuality when it's attached to buddhi. And the individuality is that portion that it reincarnates from life to life. And personality, we get a new one with every life. Does co-chair have a...
In the key, around page 173 or so, there's... a couple of pages where there are charts where proper terms are given for the different principles. And what reminded that all of manifestation is sevenfold. We can consider it in analogy when we're considering that there's white light that is emanated in the universe. When it passes through a physical prism, we get a rainbow array of seven colors. An orchestra might hit a particular note, but it may be made up of a combination of a sevenfold sounding, if you will. So these principles are basis for understanding. They are basis for energy and generation. And they are of different aspects or different applications, ranging from the higher self, the most spiritual, ethereal oneness that we can imagine, down through a divine ego, if you will, the unity of Bodhi Manas, and then what the co-chair just described as that lower quaternary, the lower aspects. So it's not that a principle is equated to a particular triad. It's just that there is a oneness of life, consciousness, perceiver in the human kingdom that can operate by choice on seven different planes in seven different ways. Does anybody have an observation on that, SL?
So if we view a principle in its broadest aspect as a basis for thought of an action, of course the mind, being gifted with reason, can reason from principles and thereby guide their behavior. But HPB tells us that the Bodhi is that faculty of directly perceiving abstract principles. So it's different from reasoning, but the power to directly perceive abstract principles. So the more we apply our minds to the reasoning and consideration of universal principles, which are abstract principles like justice and love and evolution, all those things, the more we think about that, the more we awaken Bodhi, our intuition and our discernment and even our compassion.
Thank you. MDW.
So that brings up the question, compassion, what does the heart have to do with all of this that we're talking about? It is not the mind controls everything.
What does compassion have to do with it? You know, that lofty statement that desire first arose in it being the absolute, desire as a principle, not lower passions and desires as in the physical sentient life, but a passionate desire in terms of compassion, the compassionate basis of karma, of universal justice, of universal equity, of the potentiality of evolution for all. That is the first premise that is said to arise, emanate, develop from the absolute. Well, if that's a first, is that not a seed idea, a concept, a stirring of ideation at a universal level that should be governing all of the cosmos? In our little microcosm of this one incarnation, if we hold that dear and take compassion as a seed idea when we first wake up in the morning, I'll make theosophy a living power in my life. I'll be compassionate to one and all that I encounter in this day of manifestation. If we hold on to that, we have the beginnings of a one-pointed practice. That means that we can think with the heart and feel with the mind. We can take what is apparently separate an illusion of separateness on this plane and reunite it from duality to oneness.
And the symbol of the heart is can be looked at as compassion, as love, all the higher emotions that we, as was just talked about, that we can look at on a daily, maybe even hourly basis, that we need to focus and be one-pointed about those higher emotions. And if we happen to come across something that knocks us off our higher thinking, then it's, we have to pull back and think, no, you know, let me try to get back on track at being one-pointed. And it's very hard, and it takes practice over and over again to look at what we need to do on a daily basis and from the heart center for compassion, for love, and doing for others rather and not expecting anything in return.
Mm-hmm. Our time is getting close, and we still have two chats hanging out there in the ether. The first, in trying to understand those who seem to lack principles, can they develop them in another life? Yes. If in our thinking in a particular incarnation, we are habitually stressing one principle or the other, cold logic of the lower mind, a passionate reaction, fiery personal reaction that's kama driven, spacey psychic practices. As we begin to live as ethical human beings and begin to create and think and create new strands of existence, we will pursue a path that leads us back to what another chat refers to. It seems like duality and dualism is oneness. In the Gita on page 16, we're reminded that equal-mindedness is called yoga. And there is the key to the effort that will cause us to develop the buddhi manas, equal-mindedness in the face of all events.
Thank you.
Our time is up. Thanks for coming today.